Council, my name is James Whalen. I represent Kenneth Brown. And the two issues that I'm going to use my time to discuss relates to the sufficiency of the evidence as it relates to the receipt of the $10,000 by the city of Garland. They were charged with a conspiracy to violate 18 U.S.C. 666, which is the theft and bribery statute. And one of the main elements that they had to prove at trial, which was in the jury's instructions, was that the city of Garland, Texas, received in any one-year period benefits in excess of $10,000 under a federal program involving a grant, contract, subsidy, loan guarantee, insurance, or other form of federal assistance. That was an essential element that the government had to prove. And we state in our brief and in the record, it's pretty short, the only evidence that was proffered by the government and presented by the government was from a Mr. Ken Anderson from the city of Garland. And he basically was asked the following question. As part of the funding for the city of Garland, does the city receive assistance from the federal government? Yes, yes, we do. Specifically from the years 1998 and each successive 12-month period to 2008, yes, we did. And that was the sum and substance of the evidence presented at trial. It's our position on behalf of both the Browns that that evidence is completely insufficient to support a conviction because there's no other evidence presented. And it never showed the amount of money they received. Was it a benefit from a government program? There's no evidence that they received any federal funds from a government program. You don't.
Is part of the argument that they might have received $10,000 from all the total, the sources that were listed there, the municipal, all of the sources in the context of the conversation?
I don't read it that way, Your Honor, because I think what, when they asked him about I think if you're asking about the banking accounts that they had, they have to receive more than $10,000 in each successive year. So every year, individually, they had to receive more than $10,000 of benefits from federal program.
Okay, I thought that your argument was that you could have received property taxes, they could have received property taxes, utility revenues, and other miscellaneous fees and permits, which also add up to $10,000. And whenever he was saying we have more than $10,000, we don't know the source. Is that not your argument?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Okay.
That testimony dealt with the revenue that went into the account that it appears Ms. Leathers was able to write those claims out of. And what he was testifying to is the money that went into that account was from fees, permits, miscellaneous funds. And so the argument is that account, they could have had a separate account that federal funds came into that she didn't have any control over, and that these fees were separate from any type of federal funding.
So you're not alleging any instructional error?
No.
Okay. And you're not making an insufficient because of the law in terms of not sufficient nexus?
Well, we are making an insufficient nexus argument, too, because I think the court in the case law, I mean, there's in Salinas and the Supreme Court case in Salinas and Sabry, they talked about this nexus. But this court in Whitfield, which is cited by the government, talked about that still said there has to be some nexus between the criminal conduct and the agency receiving the funds. And so there has to be some nexus or some showing. But our issue is this court can't even do that analysis because there's no evidence in the record to support that.
Okay, so again, the specific question, because the brief had a bunch of different sort of nuances to it. Are you saying that Anderson's testimony isn't sufficient because it was a leading question?
Yes, it was
but
a leading.
Nothing's wrong with a leading question if you don't object.
Right, there's nothing wrong with a leading question.
Okay, so he gives his answer. And is it your position legally there would have to be corroboration for his testimony? Or is it just that that answer isn't enough for the jury to draw the inference that the company received $10,000 on each of those years?
I think it's not sufficient. It's not enough for him just to say we received that much. Because I think in the cases that we cited, I think those cases are kind of illustrative of the analysis the court has gone through in order to determine is there a nexus, does it invoke federal jurisdiction. In all those cases that have been cited, there's always been documentary evidence. There's documents of we got the funds from the NEA or we got it from the United States Marshal Service or we had a contract in the Salinas case to to house federal prisoners.
But, Mr. Whalen, is it required that there be evidence in addition to the oral testimony of the city, the accounting manager?
It's our position that it does, because in order to establish whether or not there is a nexus between the criminal conduct and the agency, you have to determine the source of the funds and wasn't, in fact, a benefit from a federal program, because that's what the statute says. Is it a benefit from a federal program that they have to prove? So we believe that it is that they have to prove that, then more than that, because also we cite in the Jackson case, at the end of that or part of that case, it says the government must prove more than a scintilla of evidence. And so it's our position that this is less than a scintilla of evidence. It's not it's not like venue where you have
Jackson,
to
Jackson, there was lack of clarity as to which year was involved.
There was lack of clarity and lack of amount, but I think that case also shows that this court was able to look at and say there was evidence about the amount of the money that received, the exact amount, the source of the money.
Part of the problem is I don't think you crossed on this correctly, correct? You didn't turn around and cross Anderson and say, well, let's be more specific.
Right. I was not trial counsel. Yeah. I did not try the case, unfortunately.
But I didn't see it in the cross. I didn't see it come up in the closing argument.
Correct.
Now, the burden's the government's, without a doubt.
Right.
But that just, it gives us...
I agree. It was not challenged at trial, but our position is obviously the burden's on the government
right.
to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. And the record as it is, they did not prove it beyond a reasonable doubt because you can't, there was no evidence from Mr. Anderson about the source of the funds. I mean, I would concede that if they said we received grant money from Homeland Security to buy new squad cars from the police department and it was $50,000, that would give you some evidence to support that. But there's nothing in this record
so
to support.
Like, is the bank federally insured? Expert witness says, yeah, it is. I checked. And
right.
What else are they going to say?
Right, but I also would say, in addition to that, normally in those type of trials, you're going to see the certificate from
you
the
are,
FDIC.
But it's not a requirement.
I agree. It's not a requirement, but you're going to see some documentary evidence to support it. And so we believe that the evidence is completely insufficient on this element, and both convictions have to be reversed. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Carl David Metters, and I represent Leah Brown, the wife and co-defendant of Kenneth Brown. I want to start in two places. One, first with the Rule 29 issue that the government has raised, whether it was sufficient in, as it relates to Leah Brown. Leah Brown's trial counsel did make a motion for acquittal pursuant to Rule 29. And she argued, and he specifically said, that the government wholly failed to establish all of the elements of conspiracy. And while that does not specifically list out the elements, including the requirement that the city of Garland receive $10,000 annually in federal benefits, it did address all of the elements, and we think that that was sufficient to preserve it.
Assuming that I agree with you, that doesn't apply to the co-defendant, though, because the one-for-all objection required you, if the second person came in and set a more specific objection, that the first person has to go in and say, I also adopt that under the rules that y'all were going on in this trial.
Yes, ma'am, and again, I was in trial counsel as well.
But I guess your colleague might want to address that, but it seems like the miscarriage of justice, so everybody's wrong. Y'all don't both get de novo, but they don't both get miscarriage of justice either. It's a one-in-one situation, appears to be the reading of the record to me, but maybe somebody might want to talk about that if they think it's pertinent.
I believe Mr. Whalen will address it, but I will say that the court is correct in that the agreement was that it was one-for-all objections and that Leah Brown's counsel did make a more general objection. And as far as our position in the miscarriage, manifest miscarriage of justice, that if the court was to find that the Rule 29 motion was sufficient for Ms. Brown and then not for Mr. Brown, that might result in, and there was relief granted in any way, that might result in a miscarriage of justice, a manifest miscarriage of justice. And so we would... and again, Mr. Whalen will address that probably more specifically. As he has addressed the federal benefits in excess of $10,000 element, I'm not going to address that specifically, is that he has made the argument, and anything that I would add would be repetitive in summary. But I would like to briefly touch on the issue of the sentencing. Both Ms. Brown and Kenneth Brown were sentenced within the guidelines as calculated by the district court. The district court accepted basically the government's argument, which is essentially the same argument that they make today, which is that because the jury found the Browns guilty of conspiracy, that and because so many of the people involved in the conspiracy were friends, family, and acquaintances of theirs, that was enough to
warrant. Browns take the stand at sentencing?
Yes, sir.
So you got the district judge who's heard the trial, and then he hears them at sentencing deny knowledge. Why isn't that right there just moves it into credibility? They deny knowledge, and he can disbelieve their credibility, and that's going to be the end of it.
Well, and I think for the acceptance of responsibility and in part on the issue of the recruit of the 3B1.1B enhancement and the loss amount, I think so. That does go to their credibility, but it also goes to the standard is whether it's clearly erroneous and whether it was plausible in light of the whole record. And in this case, when you look at the whole record as it relates to and I'll start with the managerial and supervisory role, there was not one single witness that came in and said, I was recruited by the Browns. The evidence was that the Browns did not receive proceeds in the sense that they received an equal amount or share from the other of Devaney, Leathers, or the Staleys. Kenneth Brown and the checks that he cashed received $300 to $500.
I thought Melissa Williams' father, what's his name?
Devaney.
I thought Devaney did say that Leah gave names to him.
He said on two occasions that she did, that she, in response to a question, on two occasions, he said she gave names. Oh. But it doesn't go any further. I mean, that there were no names given that said these were given to them by Leah Brown. What the government argued, and what the testimony was, what the argument was in the record was, is that Devaney says, I don't know where these names came from. And so the government argues, well, since he didn't know where those names came from, clearly they came from the Browns. And on the issue of the recruiting of people, they didn't identify anyone a name that was given by Leah Brown. No witnesses came in and said that they were recruited. And Devaney had a plan for recruiting people. And the example that I would like to get to, which is Kevin Brown, which is the Brown's son. Devaney testifies that Kevin Brown, he recruited him. He told him the lie, the story about how to cash the check. He directed him, took him to the bank, took the proceeds, and gave him a small fee for doing it. There's no evidence in the record, and Devaney doesn't expand on it, that the Browns knew that their son was involved.
You're saying the son goes to jail because he was involved, but the mother you're suggesting didn't know?
No, sir. In fact, the son was deceased at the time of trial, and I don't know that he would have been a co-defendant. That would have been a charging issue. But he was, as an example of the individuals who were involved. There was an argument whether Devaney recruited these people or whether the Browns recruited these people.
Okay.
And for the managerial and supervisory, for that enhancement, one of the elements that you look at, or one of the issues that you look at, is did you direct these people? Did you specifically recruit them? Did you share in proceeds that were equal to others and of these people's transactions? The government asked Devaney, did you give Kenneth Brown money for Kevin Brown, your son, cashing a check? And he said no. And that's because Kenneth Brown and Leah Brown didn't share in the proceeds like Devaney, Leathers, Staley, and the other people in charge of it.
Did Leah Brown ever step in to cash checks that didn't work like Mr. Brown did?
I'm sorry. The only evidence that I have from the record is that she cashed that, and it's disputed between the trial and the sentencing, but that she cashed two checks, and those were the only checks that she was involved with.
So we, in order to reverse on this ground, we have to find that the district judge clearly erred in this, in the hearing the evidence of the sentencing, and their spouse, their children, their son-in-law, her mother, her brother, her sister-in-law, her aunt, two of the cousins and the girlfriend are all involved, and the husband is stepping in to cash checks when it's not, when some of the other ones are not. Is that what I have, what we'd have to find?
It's close. Like the brother, and in the time that I have left, and the brother, Lee Compton, he's Leah Brown's brother. He's recruited by Devaney. Devaney says, I recruited him. I didn't talk to anybody about it. I got him to do it. He had an agreement with Lee Compton. Devaney knew all of these people independent of his relationship with the Browns. And in recruiting Compton, Leah Brown's brother, they make an agreement that Leah Brown, that Compton will receive a fee. Compton wants more money. That was the testimony. And so Devaney takes that check and then takes it to Kenneth Brown. Like Kevin Brown, like Lee Compton, like so many others, there's no evidence that Leah Brown went in and recruited these people. The only evidence is that Devaney's in two instances saying that she gave him names without identifying who they were.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. The Browns argued it to the jury, just as they do to this court, that the evidence could not support a conclusion that they willfully joined the conspiracy to steal money from the city of Garland. Excuse me. But the evidence showed very strongly that they understood at the time that they cashed these checks and participated in the conspiracy, that they understood that these checks were not legitimately obtained from the city of Garland. Having not heard argument on that issue by counsel, and certainly is not the lead in their briefs, I'm happy to answer any questions that the court has or concerns that the court has about the sufficiency of the evidence that they willfully joined in the conspiracy. I submit that it is strong, and certainly viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict shows that they understood when they cashed checks in their name from the city of Garland, knowing they had no claim to this money, that what they understood these checks to be were essentially straws that allowed them to tap into the city of Garland's coffers and suck money out of it that they weren't entitled to.
Perhaps you want to move on to the $10,000 in annual federal funds element of 18 U.S.C. 666.
Yes, Judge Elrod.
The evidence is not so clear and strong, and those accolades you gave the last part of the evidence.
It is very clear. The accounting manager for the city of Garland, someone who had been in that not in that position, but in that department for 24 years. Pardon. I'm sorry. Testified clearly, we received more than $10,000 in each year of the charged conspiracy. Now, as Judge Higginson pointed out, there is not a requirement of that backup detail.
And so, why was it so thin?
Because really it was uncontested. The city of Garland, having a population of over 225,000 people and I think the sixth largest city in the state of Texas, would not shock anybody to know that the city of Garland receives more than $10,000.
But that's not the test. Would not shock anybody. And the government's been repeatedly admonished or encouraged to not do thin evidence on this precise thing for years in our case law. So why didn't the government bring some documents or have some more thorough testimony on this so that we're not having to have this argument today?
Well, the question, you know, before the court is, did this evidence, was it sufficient for the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, I'm asking, why didn't the government heed our previous admonitions and bring documents or explain through testimony, knowing that this has been a weak spot for years for the government? Why didn't the government do more here?
I don't believe we perceived that was necessary.
Were you aware of the case law where we've said repeatedly that people almost fall short and criticize this is a weak link?
Your Honor, as I stand here, I'm familiar with Jackson and was at that time. But in Jackson, it's very different. In Jackson, to use this court's language, it wasn't just that there were some vagaries. To use this court's language, the evidence demonstrated unequivocally, I think was the term that was used. And the government stipulated to the fact that the funds received were not received directly from the federal government, but instead were indirect funds through state agencies. So as Judge Higginson pointed out, there was some question that, you know, how much of that money was federal funding, and exactly when did that come?
You know, I agree with you that Jackson doesn't require the additional documentary evidence, and Jackson's facts may be distinguishable, but the question I have is why would you not have introduced and pursued the better practice of making this easier for a jury to determine? I recognize there's no controverting evidence, but I think that does Jackson, are you satisfied that the testimony by this, the accounting manager is enough evidence?
I am, because this is a person who has intimate knowledge. Certainly questions could have been asked to.
Without a doubt. But this is sufficient in your mind. That's what you're asking us to believe.
Yes, this is sufficient for a jury to conclude when Mr. Anderson, in that position to know, said in each one of those years we received more than $10,000 in federal assistance, that that was sufficient alone for the
and
jury to conclude.
And directing us to those two specific questions, certainly the second question, had it had the words federal funds, would have been clearer because that wasn't included in the second part of that two-question series, right?
It wasn't, but I think looking at the record in its totality and those two questions, they go together. I think that's perfectly fair, especially viewing this testimony in the light most favorable to the verdict that would apply here. Now, Judge Elrod, you raised the question about the preservation of the factual sufficiency in Rule 29. Certainly, Mr. Brown doesn't get the benefit of the doubt of that standard for the reasons that you pointed out. But as noted in the government's 28J letter on this issue, when Leah Brown's attorney was moving for judgment of acquittal, what he said was, Your Honor, the government has not proved mens rea, she had intentionally or willfully had gone along on the scheme, and the government failed to prove that she committed an overt act, of course, which is, you know, irrelevant. And for those reasons, because they failed on those elements, she met the legal standard, was his argument. They failed to prove all the elements of the offense. Merely making that statement did not convert specific grounds into a general motion.
It isn't quite as easy as just, is it FDIC insured? Because after Salinas, there has been disagreement among the circuits about the nexus. So I think part of their argument about insufficiency is related to what our circuit, which may have a broader concept of nexus than other circuits. That's not really a question. I guess let me try to form it as a question. In these 666B cases, Jackson, I do read it as a calendar year problem, which it doesn't seem to have here. But the nexus concern broadly might suggest to the government to ask more specific questions, even if you're in a circuit that at the moment has a more generous understanding of nexus. Here's the question. When I looked at the jury charge, even though they aren't saying there's instructional error, it looked like the government recommended, and they didn't object, to an Eighth Circuit instruction on it. So do you know our circuit has no instruction on the 66B Salinas? You didn't borrow from a Fifth Circuit pattern.
No, I don't believe we borrowed from a Fifth Circuit pattern. I suspect that there is not one is the reason we wouldn't have done that, or I suspect that we would have asked and Judge Fitzwater would have imposed a Fifth Circuit instruction. Yeah. And I would submit that Salinas doesn't stand alone. Years later, Sabri came along and addressed that item left open, which was what is the connection that's required under the Constitution between the federal funding and the misconduct.
Well, that was just sort of congressional power case, though, right, Sabri?
Right.
Does Congress have the power to even criminalize this?
Right.
It wasn't narrowing. Maybe I'm wrong. What's our circuit's best case on what's left as to a nexus?
Well, I think that it's proved by Mueller, by Phillips, and most the most contemporary one would be Whitfield.
Okay.
And that this court has to holds that the government has to connect sort of the recipient of the federal funds and the agent who is in the misconduct.
Yeah.
Here, unlike Miller and Phillips and Whitfield, there's not this large diagram of where did money go and who did they act on behalf of.
One account.
Here, well, I'll address one account, but here, regardless whether there's one account or not, what the evidence showed, it was the city of Garland, the government of Garland, which, you know, government is one of the entities under 666. It was the city of Garland that received the federal funds. There's no dispute that Patsy Leathers was an agent of the city of Garland. She had the ability to, and she had the authorization to dispose of the city of Garland's funds. And
on her signature alone?
Robbie Neal testified that she had the authority up to $10,000 without any approval to go ahead and negotiate and authorize the city to disperse up to $10,000, which is why these checks, by and large, are in the range of $6,000 to $9,000. Now, going to the one account issue, again, I would submit that it doesn't matter whether the federal funds went into that account or not. The connection has been made between the federal funds recipient, City of Garland, and the misconduct by an agent of the City of Garland. But immediately before testifying to the federal funds, Mr. Anderson, after talking about the different sources of income or revenue and things like that, the question was asked, does the city have one account for various things, including the claim settlement? Answer, yes, we do use one account. And I don't believe that it is erroneous for the jury. If this court had to satisfy itself that the federal funds went into that account, especially on the highly deferential standard that this court would apply, that it's there. But again, respectfully, I submit this court doesn't have to reach that conclusion because as going back to Westmoreland and others, this court has consistently said that the government doesn't have to prove that the misconduct threatened or was in any way connected to the federal funds themselves. Turning to sentencing issues, of course, unless the court has any questions on factual sufficiency, Judge Fitzwater determined after looking at the entire record, not explicitly said he was not bound by the trial record, looking at all the evidence that was submitted to him, he found that both of the Browns had perpetuated the scheme by recruiting others into it. That finding is far from clearly erroneous. In fact, it was well supported by the evidence that was submitted to the court. With respect to Mr. Brown, well, first let me say this. Jerry DeVinney testified consistently through his testimony. He didn't just go to members of the Brown family. Some of them he knew well enough that he could approach them directly, but some of them he didn't know that well. For instance, he cited Ken Brown's aunt, Mary Baxter, and Leah Brown's mother, Linda Edgar. These are people that he said, I wasn't comfortable enough to go to them and ask them to do a check. And that is perfectly common sense to someone running a criminal conspiracy that they're not going to just reach out to anybody and invite them in to the criminal conspiracy. And he didn't, and Jerry DeVinney did not do that here. With respect to Ken Brown, the government, in my brief, will point to two specific examples. If they want names, here are two names that the evidence shows that Ken Brown participated in their recruitment. One, Mary Baxter, and two, Mark Enloe. A conclusion that Mark Enloe was facilitated into this scheme by Ken Brown, for that evidence, we look no further than Mark Enloe's, the cousin of Ken Brown, his very first statement to FBI agents when he told them, Ken Brown recruited me into the scheme. Now, he later equivocated on that once he realized sort of the potential effect of what he was telling agents. But there's additional evidence, as pointed out in the brief, the circumstances of the Anthony Parada check, that the circumstantial evidence shows that that check was deposited into Mark Enloe's account. That's undisputed, but it came into that account along with several money orders and cashier's checks that he received, Mark Enloe received, from Ken Brown. The obvious inference that he received the Parada check along with the other money orders from Ken Brown. And in fact, at trial, Mark Enloe wouldn't dispute that and couldn't dispute that that inference. With respect to Mary Baxter, the evidence certainly shows that Ken Brown participated in her recruitment to cash a check. As I note in the brief, even when the FBI agent first reached out to Ms. Baxter to set up an interview, she didn't tell Ms. Baxter who was the subject of the investigation. She didn't say what the investigation was about, except that it involved, quote, an insurance check. Just knowing that, Ms. Baxter reached out to Rhonda Hodges, her employee and former daughter-in-law, and when the two were comparing notes, and Ms. Hodges was also a payee, when the two were comparing notes, Ms. Baxter said to Ms. Hodges that she believed this had to do with those checks involving Kenneth Wayne, indicating that she associated Ken Brown. And then she picked up the phone and called Ken Brown and talked to him about it, certainly undercutting her statement the following day to the FBI agent that, as far as she knew, Ken Brown knew nothing about her involvement in the scheme. The question was put directly to Ms. Brown, and I'm sorry, Ms. Baxter, in a polygraph whether Ken Brown had recruited her. She denied it. She showed deception. But I think finally and powerfully, Ms. Baxter did testify at sentencing, and she told this tale of how Jerry DeVinny showed up at her automotive shop and was having some work done, and while he was there for that, he asked about whether she would do a check. Again, keep in mind, Jerry DeVinny testified he didn't approach her directly because he didn't know her well enough, but she painted a picture that like they were old friends and he was an old customer. That story that she told was soundly undercut and shown to be false. It was, you know, contradicted by Jerry DeVinny. It was contradicted by his wife, who said, we didn't have our cars worked on there. And it was undercut by the documentary proof that when we went through his bank account, there were no payments to her shop. Instead, there were payments to another automotive repair shop closer to where the DeVinnys lived.
Neither Brown testified at trial, correct?
Correct.
But then they both testified at sentencing?
Correct.
What if Judge Fitzwater had said, I'm going to give her, Leah, the managerial enhancement for the sole reason that I heard her testify and deny it, and I think that's a false exculpatory answer. Would that suffice? If a district judge hears testimony and just says, I don't believe you, is that sufficient?
I'm sorry to say this, but I'm not familiar with a case that would say whether that is or is not sufficient. I know that the Second Circuit case cited in the brief, I believe Vasquez, there holds that a negative inference certainly is allowable when it's corroborated by other.
Did Judge Fitzwater make any finding that they lacked credibility at sentencing? Did he give them an enhancement for false, you know, for obstruction?
He did not. The government did not request an obstruction enhancement based on their false testimony. He did not make any explicit finding with respect to their credibility, but I think it's certainly implicit in his findings when they denied having recruited and he found otherwise.
Yeah.
And with respect to Leah Brown, certainly the evidence is supports Judge Fitzwater's finding that she recruited. And as noted previously, he did testify that she was supplying him names. When he ran out of people willing to do these checks, she was the one that kept him going by extending his network and introducing people into the scheme that, or at least names or people into the scheme that he did not know.
You're not saying the enhancement could be based on anything to do with Facebook and her, the fact that she had friended others that were known to be in the conspiracy?
No. That was never put forward as a reason or standalone reason for the managerial enhancement. It was relevant to the loss amount, and I'll explain that in the time remaining. Now, I would say that if Mr. Matters is requesting that the government point to specific people that Leah Brown recruited, first, Kendra Brown, Jerry DeVinny testified that he believed he used Leah to get to their daughter and make sure she was good with cashing a check. And although not, I don't think I cited it in the brief, but on page 428 in his cross-examination, he said even more clearly that Leah knew that their children were doing checks. And of course, Angie Smith, it's explained in the brief the circumstances that would show that Angie Smith did not know Jerry DeVinney. Jerry DeVinney did not know her. That name, the fact that she got a check in 2007, around the same time that Angie Smith ran into the Browns at a casino, circumstantial evidence that it was Leah Brown who facilitated or brought that name into the conspiracy. Very briefly, with respect to the loss amount, I want to point out a couple of things that Judge Fitzwater explicitly noted in ruling on the objections. First of all, this was a scheme that by its very nature required new people and new names. It was not going to succeed. It was not going to be perpetuated without new names. They knew that. Mr. and Mrs. Brown understood that. Leah Brown was out there recruiting. Ken Brown understood that he was cashing checks in several different names. Second, because the scheme was jointly undertaken criminal activity, of course, 1B1.3 would say that loss amount included those checks that were reasonably foreseeable. And finally, that the district court was not required to establish with perfect precision what the loss amount was. Instead, it was required to come up with a reasonable estimate, and here it did. It included both the checks that they cashed and the checks that were reasonably foreseeable. I see that my time is up, if I may continue in 10 seconds. These checks were reasonably foreseeable because they knew that their friends and family were among the pool that either they were recruiting or Jerry DeVinney was recruiting from, and that pool was reasonably foreseeable to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Just real quick to discuss the Rule 29 question that Judge Elrod that you had. It was the standard did appear that what Judge Fitzwater said was if you make an objection, the other person will adopt it unless you have more to add. And so then the question becomes, did Mr. Brown's counsel need to come back around and then say, well, then I adopt Mr. Haney's objection? And so it's not in the record, and I agree that it's not in the record, but my position would be taken as a whole, that is, it would be a general motion. But additionally, we would argue that if the court finds that Ms. Brown's objection was a general objection, and you're reviewing her case de novo and find that there was insufficient evidence on the $10,000 issue, that then not overturn Mr. Brown's conviction, that would result in a miscarriage of justice. And so I think if you look at it that way, that there would be a miscarriage of justice not to overturn both convictions, and that would be our position as it relates to that. I did want to address, I think the issue came, what's the most recent case out of the Fifth Circuit? I think the Whitfield case really is the case, and I think it's post-Salinas and it's post-Sabry. And I think the facts in that case are very illustrative as well, because you had a bribery scheme where judges in Mississippi two judges were accepting money for favorable rulings in cases brought by this specific lawyer. And the facts show that the judges were members of the Office of Court Administration. They received $40,000 per year, and that money was specifically to hire staff, clerks, secretaries, and that nature. And because the court ruled that they were agents of the OCA, the Office of Court Administration, but in this fact scenario, they were receiving bribes to affect outcomes in cases, and that there wasn't a nexus between their receipt of the $40,000 and the bribes they received. What the court went on to say was, had they received a bribe in exchange for hiring a relative as a legal clerk or as a secretary that pertained to the $40,000, that would have been a different case. And I think that is why it's so important that there has to be some evidence in this record about the source of the funds, the nature of the funds. Was it a benefit from a government program in order for this court to make that determination? On this record, you cannot make that determination. The evidence is clearly insufficient as it relates to that element. The government had the burden to do it, and they failed. And I think when you look at all those cases, it's important. And we also cited the Phillips case. And the Phillips case was important because in the Phillips case, you had a tax assessor in a Louisiana parish who was accepting bribes. And the issue became, was he part of the parish? and because the parish did receive federal funding. And the court ruled he wasn't an agent of the parish because he was elected separately. The funds didn't affect his office in any way. So the analysis has to be done, and you have to have that information to do that analysis. And I think when you look at all the Fifth Circuit cases, especially the Whitfield case, the evidence is clearly insufficient, and we'd ask you to reverse both their convictions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.